is that given the Supreme Court's recent ruling, overruling the Chevron case, which says that courts have to give deference to agencies' interpretations of laws, that no longer exists. That's been overruled. And as our lawyer laid forth in the complaint, now the courts can look more closely at how an agency, at how an agency or a department implements, or in the case of Israel, fails to implement the law.
We just have 30 seconds, but Ahmed Moore, I wanted to ask why you joined this lawsuit. And given that so many of your family are still in Gaza, those that have survived, their response?
The conditions are dire. I'm writing an essay now about child amputees, and I spoke with a child and her mother, a double amputee in Gaza. The conditions of basic life are not being met. Gaza is unlivable. Never mind things like potable water or taking a shower in the morning. Think about defecating in the open, being a woman or a girl who can't, who's menstruating. The basic conditions of life in Gaza aren't being met. And the fact that there aren't being met is a matter of policy, policy that our government is supporting.
Ahmed Moore, Palestinian-American writer, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the State Department, and Charles Blaha, former State Department official, served as director of the office responsible for implementing the Leahy Law. Coming up, we speak with the sister and husband of Ayesh Noor Ezgi Aigi, the American human rights activist who just recently graduated from University of Washington in Seattle. She was killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank this year. Stay with us. War by Tony Tuff, the longtime conscious roots reggae singer, passed away at the age of 69 in April. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Biden administration's coming under criticism this week for failing to independently investigate the killing of Ayesh Noor Ezgi Aigi, the 26-year-old American activist shot to death by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank in September. The recent University of Washington UW graduate was fatally shot in the head after taking part in a weekly protest against illegal Israeli settlements in the town of Beita. Witnesses say she was shot by an Israeli sniper after the demonstration had already dispersed. On Monday, members of her family met with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, but left the meeting saying they had little hope the U.S. will hold Israel accountable. Her family also held a vigil outside the White House on Monday night and a press conference on Tuesday outside the Capitol, where speakers included Democratic Congress member Pramila Jayapal of Washington State.
Outside reporting, including an in-depth investigation by the Washington Post, directly challenges the Israeli government's account of what happened and how Ayesh Noor was killed. This investigation found that Ayesh Noor was shot more than 30 minutes after the confrontation that the IDF claimed to be responding to had already ended. And she was killed from more than 200 yards away, horrifically shot in the head. That is not a, quote, mistake, as the IDF has claimed. That is not accidental. I am absolutely appalled with the lack of movement on this case, the lack of attention from the State Department, the U.S. State Department, for the well-being and the safety of our own U.S. citizens. Nothing that I have heard from the State Department gives me any assurance at all that the killing of a United States citizen by the IDF is being treated with the urgency that it deserves. And this is all particularly galling when the U.S. continues to provide unfettered aid to Israel, bullets, bombs, weapons, violating our own domestic Leahy laws and international humanitarian law.
That was Democratic Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, represents Seattle, where Aishinord also grew up and went to college. Pramila Jayapal was speaking Tuesday at a news conference calling for a U.S. probe into Aishinord Ezgi Aigi's death, shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. We're joined now by Aishinord's sister, Ozden Bennett, and her husband, Hamed Ali. We thank you so much both for joining us and our deepest condolences on the death of your wife and your sister. Ozden, if you could start off by talking about your meeting with Blinken, if both of you weigh in, why did he agree to meet with you? Your sister is an American citizen, and what he promised.
Mm-hmm. My sister's killing happened over 3 months ago, so we waited a long time to meet with Secretary Blinken. And unfortunately, we didn't get a lot out of that meeting on Monday with him. He stuck to a lot of his talking points, which was that they will review the rules of engagement and conduct within the Israeli military because of their escalations and actions, and essentially kept deferring to the Israeli investigation. Anytime that we countered the comments that he was making, he would just circle back and repeat the same things.
Hamed, let me ask you, has President Biden called you on the death of your wife, or Ozden, on the death of your sister?
No. President Biden has not reached out to us directly.
I wanted to ask, State Department spokesperson Matt Miller said Monday that Blinken told you that, quote, that Israel has told us in recent days they're finalizing their investigation into the matter. Have you received any communication from the Israeli government at all?
No, we haven't received any communication from the Israeli government. I mean, we've received three pictures with some captions from the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem via from the Israeli government via the embassy in Jerusalem. But that's about it. There's been no other communication.
And when we ask Blinken for what communication or documents or anything they've received from Israel themselves, the answer was nothing at this time.
Hamed, can you tell us about your wife? The university, went to University of Washington, graduated, and then what happened on that fateful day?
Yes, as I understand it, and as I've been told by eyewitnesses, and as I've read in the Washington Post investigation, she attended a weekly demonstration in Beta against an illegal Israeli settlement. She was there as an international observer. She was not part of the protests in the same way that she was not participating necessarily. She was there to document and as a protective presence and to bear witness, really, of their right to protest against that illegal settlement. She was standing under an olive tree. She had just helped an older woman who was also there as an international observer who had just sprained her ankle. And the last conversation that they had was that they felt safe in that position underneath that olive tree. And then that's when she was shot.
And Ozden, could you tell us, your sister was drawn to advocating for human rights around the world. Could you talk about her growing up and her decision to get involved in these kinds of activities?
Mm-hmm. Growing up, even from a young age, she was just always very drawn to helping her community, helping people in need, taking mentorship positions, volunteering where she could. And starting in high school, she became really politically engaged in the Seattle community around Trump's election, for example. She was really moved by Bernie Sanders and his messaging. She was really moved against what Trump was messaging at the time and trying to implement. And she really rallied protests at that time in Seattle. And through the years, she's volunteered abroad in Myanmar to help relief efforts there. She related to what's happened in Gaza since October 7th, had raised over $40,000 working with the community at large, putting together a fundraiser, an art fundraiser, to help give aid to children in Gaza. She was a huge part of the student leadership that led the encampment movement on the campus of University of Washington. She was at the negotiations table trying to push the president and the administration on campus to divest from certain companies that were harming Palestinians. And even after all that, she felt like what she had done wasn't enough. And she felt moved to do what she could. And she felt like, in her words, the least she could do was to go there, bear witness as an international observer and document the injustices that she was seeing and hopefully be have the Israeli military think twice before using lethal action, which unfortunately is what killed her that day.
Hamid Ali, you wrote an op-ed in The Hill newspaper in Washington that was headlined, "Why isn't Israel being held accountable for killing my wife and other innocents?" If you can answer that question right now, and what exactly Blinken said he is waiting for, if he's talking about an Israeli military investigation, I wanted to go back to what the State Department originally said. Matt Miller saying Israel has told us in recent days they're finalizing their investigation. You're meeting with all sorts of Congress members, right? Jim McGovern, Pramila Jayapal, Senators Jeff Merkley, Chris Van Hollen. Chris Van Hollen, who's called for the release of the investigation of the well-known journalist, also American, the Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed, what, May 11th, 2022, by an Israeli sniper as she was covering the Israeli raids into the Jenin refugee camp. What would it look like if the U.S. held Israel accountable for the death of your wife?
Well, simply to begin, accountability starts with an investigation by the U.S. of the killing of one of its own citizens by an ally. I think that's where it starts. Accountability, I mean, nothing will bring my wife back, but at the very least, we can hold those who were responsible, for example, the soldier who fired that bullet, the unit commander who gave the order, and anyone else responsible for that action being taken, face some sort of punishment. Because I think the answer to the question of why my wife is not getting justice is because Israel enjoys this level of impunity throughout its existence that no other country, no other state in the world enjoys, and it seems to be unconditional at this point. I mean, I don't know what else needs to happen.
And are you calling for something to happen before Trump takes office? Are you concerned about what will happen next?
I think it should happen as soon as possible. We've been saying this since September. I don't think the election has anything to do with it. I don't think Trump coming into office changes anything. I think I hope any administration would take seriously the killing of one of its citizens. So 30 days are left in this administration. That's a long time, I think, for someone to just simply make a statement, namely President Biden or Secretary Blinken, to just say, hey, I think we need an investigation into the killing of Aisha Noor. Because there's still a lot of time, and I don't want to take ownership off of the administration for what's happened here.
And Ahmed, I wanted to ask you, she was also a dual citizen. She was a citizen of the U.S. and Turkey, and Turkey has opened its own investigation into the killing. Have you heard anything from the Turkish government?
The Turkish investigation is ongoing as far as I know. I don't know as many of the details there, but I think it just speaks to the stark contrast into these two governments of which she was a citizen. My wife was a citizen. One government has taken no pause, no hesitation to begin seeking justice for one of its citizens. And the other government, the U.S., has been dragging its feet, basically not doing anything and letting the military and the government responsible for killing her take the lead and investigate themselves, which we've seen historically has never proven any accountability, has never brought forward any accountability, especially, like you said, in the current administration, even with Shireen Ebu Akla that you mentioned earlier.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. And again, our deepest condolences. Ahmed Ali is the husband of Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi, the 26-year-old American Turkish citizen who was shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank in September. We'll link to your article in The Hill. And we want to thank Azden Bennett, the sister of Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi. They have both just returned from a meeting with the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken. Coming up, we look at Donald Trump's war on the press as he sues the Des Moines Register and ABC News settles a lawsuit that Donald Trump brought against them for over $15 million. It's not clear why. Stay with us. The Present by Kapla. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at Donald Trump's renewed war on the press, which he's often called the enemy of the people. And in one recent rally, he talked about how someone could shoot through the press. On Monday, the president-elect sued the Des Moines Register. Parent company is Gannett and the pollster Ann Seltzer for publishing a poll just before the election that showed Trump trailing Harris in Iowa. Well, Trump ended up easily winning the state. He's now accusing the paper of committing, quote, brazen election interference, unquote. Trump laid out his plans to target the Des Moines Register and other news outlets during a news conference Monday at Mar-a-Lago.
And I feel I have to do this. I shouldn't really be the one to do it. It should have been the Justice Department or somebody else, but I have to do it. It costs a lot of money to do it, but we have to straighten out the press. Our press is very corrupt, almost as corrupt as our elections.
Trump's lawsuit against the Des Moines Register came just days after ABC News, which is owned by Disney, settled a defamation suit filed by Trump. The network agreed to donate $15 million to Trump's presidential library and pay $1 million in legal fees to Trump's lawyer. Trump sued the network after ABC anchor George Stephanopoulos said Trump was found liable for rape in a 2023 civil case in Manhattan brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. ABC has been widely criticized for agreeing to settle instead of going to court to fight what many believed to be a winnable case. The prominent attorney, Mark Elias, responded to the settlement by writing, "Knee bent, ring kissed, another legacy news outlet chooses obedience, unquote. The New York Times is reporting Trump and his allies are threatening to file more defamation lawsuits and attempt to crack down on unfavorable media coverage. Trump has also picked Kash Patel to head the FBI. Patel has a record of threatening to go after journalists. We're joined now by Chris Layman, D.C. bureau chief for The Nation. His latest piece is headlined, Trump's attack on the free press is just getting started. Chris, start off with the Des Moines Register suit and then move on to ABC. What's happening here?
Well, what's happening is a very clear pattern in Trump's public life. It actually well antedates his rise to political power. He made a practice of frequently going after journalists for defamation. He famously sued one of his biographers who wrote in his this biography that Trump did not qualify as a billionaire. And in his subsequent deposition, Trump basically said he was a billionaire because he felt like a billionaire. This is a longstanding pattern of just intimidation of the press. And Trump was very open as a private business person that that was his aim. He wanted to exert a chilling effect on people doing critical reporting from him. Now, of course, he has the awesome power, the federal government behind him, or prospectively behind him, and ABC disgracefully capitulated right away. And the Des Moines Register suit is a clear auger of what's lying ahead. At the Mar-a-Lago conference you mentioned, Trump also threatened to sue Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, the Pulitzer Prize, Pulitzer Peace Prize committee for these, you know, alleged offenses against basically Trump's bottomless vanity. So by capitulating, you know, sort of preemptively the way ABC has, this news organization has set the stage for a torrent of similar suits like this. You know, Trump will and his henchmen like Kash Patel, also Pete Hegseth, has threatened a defamation suit against the person alleging sexual assault against him. You know, this will be a prime MO of the second Trump administration, and it's very worrisome that even before Trump takes office, ABC is without cause, you know, giving in. It sends a very distressing signal. In point of fact, what George Stephanopoulos said on the air was just a paraphrase of what the judge in Trump's, in the E. Jean Carroll case, said. He said that even though Trump's conduct in the case did not rise to the strict definition of rape under New York law, any common sense understanding of rape suggests that Trump did, in fact, commit that act.
So the judge said that.
The judge in the case. So there is not, this was not George Stephanopoulos just randomly popping off on the air. It was a documented claim.
And Chris, I wanted to ask you, in the Des Moines Register lawsuit, Trump is alleging consumer fraud by the Des Moines Register as a weapon. Could you talk about that particularly, and also the impact on these media companies, of many of which tend to want to settle just to get rid of a lawsuit?
Right, right. Yeah, the fraud charge is, you know, as far as I know, has no legal basis. You can't, you know, just say because a pollster got something wrong, there's some deliberate intent to mislead. It's a plainly frivolous suit, but that is the point. This is a show of power on the part of an administration that we know from its prior turn in office takes every opportunity to demonize, harass, and intimidate the free press. So, you know, the Des Moines Register suit is very much like the Trump biography suit I mentioned earlier. It's just his vanity was affronted by poll findings that, you know, turn out to be wrong. You know, I don't know what he can assert the damage has been if he won Iowa by 15 points after this poll was released. It is just a plain effort to harass and intimidate. To its credit, the Register's parent company, unlike Disney, which owns ABC, indicates it will be putting up a robust defense and, you know, in a sane court system, they will prevail. But, you know, all of this takes resources and money. And as you mentioned, Juan, you know, big companies don't want to be bothered with the hassle of, you know, going to court, even though, you know, these companies also have libel insurance precisely for cases like this. And they don't actually, you know, tend to suffer in terms of the bottom line.
I mean, this is extremely serious. When you look at the amount that ABC settled for, they were just about to go to depositions, right, of George Stephanopoulos and Trump, to discovery. So ABC called that off. $15 million plus another million for lawyers' fees. Any smaller news organization couldn't possibly deal with something like this. Then you have these news divisions that are not, you know, profitable. They only profit democracy, but a so-called, you know, financially profitable from these multinational or these very large corporations that are own lots of other things like Bezos with the Washington Post.
Right.
And they care more about that other stuff. They don't want to be seen unfavorably by Trump. So they settle on the news issue. This is so extremely disturbing.
Yeah, and this is what happens when you have large corporations who are not, they don't have journalistic values, they don't have journalistic priorities. You know, as you said, the news operations are lost leaders for these figures. And Jeff Bezos has billions of dollars in government contracts, a publisher of the LA Times. It's the same story. He has extensive pharmaceutical holdings that are come under federal regulation. So he, too, is preemptively knuckling under to the Trump administration. He's killed editorials critical of Trump. He's installed this absurd new feature for readers of the paper to track bias, and he's insisted that anything critical of Trump run alongside in the op-ed section something that's the opposite point of view. This is more than just callow both sidesism. This is just craven corporate misconduct.
That's and Patrick Soon-Shiong, who owns the Los Angeles Times.
Thank you. Yes. So, yeah, this
Chris,
is what happens.
Chris, I wanted to ask you, we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you about the potential, what Trump could do with the FCC, especially in terms of broadcasters. Are there any concerns in that area?
Oh, absolutely. Cameron Barr, his nominee to head the FCC, is a very vocal critic of, you know, what in MAGA land is considered, you know, mainstream media censorship. He has gone on and on about how big tech in particular is, you know, during COVID and at other times have allegedly suppressed pet MAGA causes and talking points. So, there's a very real and immediate danger of, you know, the call will be coming from inside the White House soon when, you know, Trump's FCC starts implementing policy. And it is all of a piece. It's really important to underline that, you know, what we're going to see, I think, is what happened in Hungary under Orbán's rise to power. Trump and J.D. Vance are both ardent admirers of Viktor Orbán, and Orbán basically used his version of Elon Musk to buy out the national press and turn it into a you know, party propaganda arm. And, you know, that is a very real and present danger with Trump coming back into power and feeling this kind of impunity and this drive to avenge the people he sees as his enemies. It's crucial that the press hold the line and, you know, follow the example of the Des Moines Register and not the example of ABC News.
We want to thank you, Chris Lehman, for being with us, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation. We'll link to your piece Trump's attack on the free press is just getting started. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Anjali Kamat, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias. Our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Teach my children about systemic racism and about historic and persistent colonialism and the responsibility that comes with their privilege. I will use my voice to speak up, and I will make more space at the table.
I will continue to educate myself and others in my community about the racism and inequities faced by BIPOC.
We will not be silent and idle.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
CJSF 90.1 FM wishes you a bright winter solstice.
Radio Rewind.